to us being nominated for the National Register, the University of California, that is. And the chairman of the commission, when they voted unanimously, was just incensed by the fact that they would write the only letter of opposition. How can you oppose the national historic importance of People's Park? But well, they so, did.
Some folks might say that that's indicative of the sort of corporate education direction that the UC system has been going in anyway. They're finding themselves more closer to running their own university, their own house, as a corporate entity for profit, rather than as an educational institution that's going to serve the diversity and the majority of the people in our state of California. Listen, guys, I'm going to go. Again, this is Flashpoint San Pacifico Radio, and you're listening to my guest today, Joe Leisner and Harvey Smith. Both of them represent the People's Park Historic District Advocacy Group. But you guys,
you are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Lady Sings the Blues, a tribute to Billie Holiday 2023. On Saturday, April 8th, from 8 p.m. to 10:45 p.m. at the Alberta Rose Theater in Portland. The 16th annual Billie Holiday tribute brings together musicians of many genres to pay tribute to influential jazz singer and songwriter Billie Holiday. Performances feature Marsha Hawker, LaRonda Steele, Arietta Ward, and more. Again, that's the 16th annual Billie Holiday Tribute Night, Lady Sings the Blues, on Saturday, April 8th, from 8 p.m. to 10:45 p.m. at the Alberta Rose Theater, 3000 Northeast Alberta Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 11:01 a.m. Next up is the bike show.
You can ride in the rain. It takes two pedals, two wheels, and a chain. Everybody.
Hello, and welcome to the KBOO Radio Bike Show, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon on 90.7 FM and streaming live on https://kboo.fm. All shows are also available on www.bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. My name is Alon Robb, and I will be joined today by co-host Nedra Deadweiler. Our engineer is Ty Walker, and we are happy that you, the listeners, are here with us today. I hope this day finds you well and healthy. In the past 2 months in Portland, we had a few snowy and icy days. I waited till the snow and ice melted before I got on my bike, but I noticed some hardy souls plowing through, ignoring the elements. Our first guest today could relate to those adventurous souls. Jessica Cherry will speak with us from Anchorage, Alaska. She is a geoscientist, writer, and commercial airline pilot, and also the co-editor of a wonderful new anthology called Wheels on Ice, Stories and Accounts of Cycling in Alaska Since the 1890s. She will speak about some of the challenges and joys of cycling in the snow and on frozen lakes. In the second half of the show, co-host Nedra Deadweiler, who is based in Atlanta, will speak with fellow Atlanta cyclist and activist Devin Counts. Devin is the founder of the Atlanta chapter of Radical Adventure Riders. The national organization was founded in 2017, and is at the forefront of creating more inclusive spaces in the cycling community, seeking to center the experiences of Black, Indigenous, people of color, queer, trans, and non-binary riders. As always, I am happy to be joined by co-host Nedra Deadweiler. Hello, Nedra. How are you today?
Oh, doing excellent, Alon.
And what's new in your part of the world, personally and city-wise?
Oh, right. We have just reached an 85-degree day. I think it might be the first this year. And, yeah, we're gearing up for a beautiful spring or launch of summer. So.
Well, if you were in Portland, you would have experienced this week some hail, rain, and some sunshine. I will say bye for now, Nedra, but we will be back with you and with the guest, Devin Counts, around the half-hour mark.
Sounds great.
All right. Thank you. Our first guest today, Jessica Cherry, is in Anchorage, Alaska. Jessica is a geoscientist, writer, and commercial airline pilot, and the co-editor of a new anthology called Wheels on Ice, Stories and Accounts of Cycling in Alaska Since the 1890s. Good morning, Jessica, and welcome to the Bike Show.
Good morning, Alon. Thank you for having me.
You sound as if you're next to me here in the studio, the wonders of technology. So, before we get to the book and some of the wonderful stories and accounts, I wanted to ask you about yourself. Were you always a cyclist? In the book, you say you grew up in Nebraska. So what are some of your early cycling experiences?
Yeah, thanks, Alon. I probably started out like just about everybody else as a kid with a bike from the superstore and you know, ribbons on the handlebars. And then eventually I moved up to what we called at the time a 10-speed that I think I bought for $5 at a yard sale. And I think in the mid-90s then I got one of the first sort of mass production hybrids that Gary Fisher was putting out at the time, and those were kind of a novelty, and I tootled around on the rail to trails in my hometown. And then in college I got into a little bit of racing for the college team, mostly just for fun. A little more serious on road biking, and came up to Alaska about 17 years ago, and here I do still a lot of road biking and a little bit of fat biking here in the winter.
And the book is dedicated to several individuals, including your uncles, Dan, Tim, and Joel. You write that they showed me that life on the bike is better. Were they the people who introduced you to cycling? And
yeah, you know, I love all my uncles. They've been good role models. And my uncle Dan had Parkinson's disease. And one of the ways that he coped with that was through cycling. And he had one of these very heavy-duty tricycles that he was able to maneuver despite his disease. And it really improved his mindset to get outside and exercise despite just his incredible progression of his disease. My other uncles, Tim and Joel, raced when they were in high school back in also in Nebraska, and have been lifelong cyclists and are now in their 70s and still riding. And it's a way of coping with aging and the stress of everyday life. So I found that very inspiring.
And you are one of those people that seem to get about five lifetimes into one lifetime. You are a geoscientist, aerial photographer, commercial airline pilot, writer. Do you employ hundreds of people for all these tasks? How do you balance all this? And can you tell us a little bit about these varied lives?
Sure. Yeah. And I should make a little correction. I'm sorry. I'm an airplane pilot. And so I have just flown for myself over the years and had a little airborne photography and mapping company And you know, when you move up to Alaska, you are essentially required to become a pilot, right? Not really, but it's a wonderful way to get around the state and see things. And I'm a scientist, and I have worked in research in ranging from oceanography to hydrology and the study of permafrost and glaciers and all the Alaska things, and have managed to be able to study those with in part with my airplane. So that has been pretty rewarding. And though as I start to grow older, I think about maybe it's time to focus more on getting back to riding bikes and kind of the simple stuff. And so I have been writing about some of my adventures, and both in science and other parts of life. And then this project sort of fell into my lap, this opportunity to partially reprint these historical gold rush tales in our book Wheels on Ice, and then had a chance with my writing mentor Frank Sos then to find some stories kind of from the rise of recreational cycling here in Alaska in the 80s and 90s, and then to solicit some news stories from contemporary writers about the Idita bike and some other more contemporary adventures. So,
and as a scientist, do you work for the state or for a private company? I mean,
yeah. So, right now, I work for the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration. I am the climate services director for the state under NOAA, and so I represent NOAA's climate data and satellite enterprise, and so I still maintain my kind of expertise in remote sensing from satellites and aircraft and drones, and but advise on the issues of climate change. And so, maybe you see some inconsistencies between my interest in flying airplanes and, my interest in climate resiliency and solutions. But, our region up here in Alaska has a lot of challenges for transportation and for critical services in communities that need medical care and food supply. And much of Alaska is not on the road system. And so we maintain a culture of aviation to help keep those communities resilient and provide 21st century healthcare and education and all those things. So,
and without ruining your day, do most people in Alaska believe that climate change is real, that climate catastrophe? Are the politicians there still denying it? And I don't mean to ruin your day, so give me a very short answer.
I think virtually every Alaskan has seen definitive evidence of a changing climate. We see the receding glaciers and the changes in the seasonality, and our subsistence fish and caribou and moose, things that people value here as healthy resources for our local food security. I think very few people deny those things. Figuring out what the solutions are, of course, is more challenging. Mm-hmm. And so people argue about the future of the oil and gas economy, certainly the future of commercial fishing and concerns about bycatch impacting our salmon, international bycatch. Of course, our oil and gas market is strongly impacted also by international affairs and the war in Ukraine. And so it's complicated. We want to maintain a functioning local economy and jobs and workforce training, all those things. So I think, developing new technical solutions to, say, electrify aviation will be very interesting to see if that is scalable to Alaska. I know that a couple of the regional aviation companies have invested in testing electric aircraft now. That's super, super exciting. But of course, we don't have all the infrastructure to generate power to charge electric vehicles yet. So
all right.
Lots of issues.
Well, thank you for that reply. Well, you are listening to the KBO Radio Bike Show, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon on 90.7 FM and streaming live on kbo.fm. And all our shows are also available on www.bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. My name is Alon Robb, and my co-host is Nedra Deadweiler. And we're speaking with Jessica Cherry, who is in Anchorage, Alaska. She is a geoscientist, a writer, a pilot, and co-editor of Wheels on Ice, Stories and Accounts of Cycling in Alaska. So let's get to the book. The book's first part is titled Bicycling in Alaska, 1898 to 1908. And the invention of the modern safety bicycle actually corresponded to the gold rush. Who were some of these first cyclists? Were they all men, or were there some women cyclists? And did the bicycle aid at all in gold mining, fishing, hunting, life in general?
Yeah, I don't know that we know a whole lot about these early cyclists. They were making use of opportunities to be present in the gold fields and the surrounding economies. And their adventures were reported in early newspapers. So I'm not sure always the accuracy, of those reports. But, from searching in the photographic archives, we know there were also early women cyclists and early indigenous cyclists. And unfortunately, we don't have stories from them other than what we found in photographs. But they were, the early cyclists were traveling this whole system of roadhouses that had been set up some of early as the fur trade prior to the gold rush. But during the gold rush and the installation of the Washington, Alaska cable and telegraph system, there were telegraph cabins up and down some of these trails that are now correspond to some highways were actually traditional indigenous trails that have existed for time immemorial. So it's very interesting to hear new ways of travel than via bicycle that came at the end of the 19th century.
And the book includes some wonderful accounts by early cyclists with names like Max Hirschberg, H.B. Levy, Edward Jason, that rode around 1900 over the frozen Yukon River. And I Googled, I Googled map to see the routes that they did, and I was informed that there's no way of traveling over there, no way, any form of transportation. So how did these people ride, in those roads? You said there were some maybe trails, but how do they deal with the harsh weather? What do they do when snow starts falling? Do they build a little snow cave And these questions are from someone who grew up in the warm Mediterranean climate and has never been to Alaska. So be patient with me. But how do you overcome those kind of conditions in 1895, you know?
Yeah, you know, I think all three of those early stories took place in the springtime. And there we have a reliable ice pack on, for example, the Yukon River. And so people would have been traveling these trails on the Klondike route up through Skagway, originally the Chilkoot Trail, and then later the White Pass route. And then they would have picked up the Yukon River, probably at Dawson, and then ridden right on the river. And what happens is that, you know, other people traveling via dog sled would have been kind of packing down trails. And so they would not have been fat bicycles, but heavier duty tires. And those are still the routes that people are traveling today on the river. So there'll be snow on the river, but it will have the wind will have kind of scoured the river during winter too. So you have ice is actually pretty relatively easy to bike on, and not to say it wasn't challenging, but that is our rivers in Alaska are really even today with what we call snow machines, also known as snowmobiles, the rivers are often the easiest routes to travel.
And the book also contains a fascinating account by Nick Hansen, who's a member of the Inupiaq community. As the Native community is cycling an important part of Native life, or...
Well, I can't speak for the whole community, mm-hmm. which of course is super diverse, right. But I think we have a couple different windows into the way people use bikes, especially in rural communities, and that is, you know, a bicycle is going to get shipped in and it's probably never going to leave. So people ride old bikes and Franken bikes that have been pieced together from other bikes. And, you know, they make do with what they have, but sports and cycling is one of those are important sources of exercise and community and mental health. And we have basketball, for example, super popular in rural Alaska. We're just getting through our March Madness high school tournaments for basketball, but mm-hmm. there are not a lot of roads. And so what Nick describes in his telling is, you know, kind of riding sand dunes with a BMX bike. And Nick is young. He's I think in his late 30s now. And so really grew up pretty recently and transitioned from BMX biking into what we call the Eskimo Nupiut Olympics here, and then he got into the American Ninja competitions and calls himself the Eskimo Ninja. So he is a really cool guy and very dedicated to promoting mental health in our rural communities and sports and spending time outdoors as part of that.
Sounds like a wonderful man. Our time has just zoomed by like maybe your plane. I don't know. so we have about 5 minutes, but I wanted to ask you a few questions. First, about the bike race that Bicycling Magazine has described as arguably cycling's hardest and coldest competition. What is this race, and do they use new bikes, or do people have to stick to old bikes? I'm talking about the idea to bike. I hope that's how it's pronounced.
Yeah. So this race started actually not too long after the revival of the Iditarod. And so it was late 1980s. People were interested in following the Iditarod dog race route with bicycles. And at the time, these were mountain bikes, pretty early mountain bikes, and pretty difficult conditions. But again, it's a trail. It's been there's been a little bit of grooming, either from dog sleds or snow machines. Now it's the snow machine racers go through first and then the bikes. But it's actually now a multi-sport event. Hmm. So foot race and skiing. And there's a 350-mile version and then a 1,000-mile to go all the way to Nome. But Alaskans were actually really involved in the early invention of fat biking, mm-hmm. you know, with the Snowcat tires mm-hmm. that were, or the rims that were invented up in Fairbanks. And so this was really the first testing grounds then in the 90s for the fat tires. And they're very suitable for the conditions. They're can still be a lot of pushing, you know, if there's a big snowstorm. Always windy, but I think very rewarding for the people involved.
And you mentioned climate change. Is the state of Alaska investing in cycling infrastructure, education?
That's an interesting challenge because all of our communities have, you know, different microclimates. Mm-hmm. We had here in Anchorage this year our heaviest snowfall ever, and a lot of municipal budget cuts that really impacted trail maintenance and even just basic transportation, bus service and things in the city. And so it's been a very challenging year, not just for cyclists, but people who use wheelchairs, who mm-hmm. use the bus system, et cetera. Other communities have different challenges with maintaining routes and you know, street clearance in some communities is partially funded through gas taxes here at least. And, you know, so what's the mechanism for cyclists, you know, to fund trail clearance? So it's an interesting discussion, tremendous costs for maintaining infrastructure in winter. But, you know, the benefits of just that many fewer cars on the road are huge. So I think that needs to be part of the calculus.
And finally, what is next for you? What other career or path are you on right now or maybe in the next 10 years?
That's a great question. I'm actually thinking about retiring from airplane flying and focusing back on the bicycle. And I have my eye on a gravel bike so that I can do some more touring and enjoy life at a slightly slower speed.
And if you make it to Portland, don't be a stranger. I can't promise to provide you with ice or frozen lakes or rivers. Before we go, I just want to, you know, you mentioned your co-editor and Frank Susan. I read a little bit about him and, you know, was really saddened to read that he died actually in a bicycle accident in Maine. So, you know, wherever he is in this universe, I hope he listens to our show and just want to send him a lot of, you know, appreciation for his work and life, and may his memory be blessed. So we've been speaking with Jessica Cherry, who is the co-editor of a wonderful new anthology from the University of Nebraska Press, Wheels on Ice. Thank you so much for your time and your good work in the world, and safe cycling and enjoyable.
Thank you, Alon.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thank you. You are listening to the KBO Radio Bike Show, hosted by Nedra Deadweiler and Alon Robb. The show could be heard live on 90.7 FM and streaming on KBO.FM. We have been speaking with Jessica Cherry from Alaska. She's a geoscientist, writer, airline pilot, and a co-editor of the highly recommended new anthology, Wheels on Ice, which is about cycling in her state since the 1890s. Thank you, Jessica, for being with us today and sharing your knowledge and love of cycling, and much success to you with your work and life. In the second half of the show, co-host Nedra Deadweiler will speak with Atlanta cyclist and activist Devin Counts, founder of the Atlanta chapter of Radical Adventure Riders, a national organization which is at the forefront of creating more inclusive spaces in the cycling community. We will take a short break for a few KBOO station messages. Stay tuned. All right. Well, I thought there were messages, but maybe they're transmitted through telepathy or other ways. So welcome back. You're listening to the KBO Radio Bike Show, co-hosted by Nedra Deadweiler and Alon Robb. And we're broadcasting from Portland, Oregon on 90.7 FM and streaming on KBO.fm. My co-host, Nedra Deadweiler, will speak in the second half of the show with Atlanta cyclist and activist Devin Counts. Nedra, take it away.
Okay, great. Thank you, Alon. Hello, I would like to welcome Devin Counts, who is a connector, community organizer, and backpacker. If you see her Instagram feed, you'll want to play the game, Where is Devin? She focuses on increasing access, training, education, and support those in the outdoors for Black, Indigenous, and people of color. She manages Radical Adventure Riders ACO, a cycling community for trans, non-binary, femme, and women riders of all experiences and skill levels. Devin also coordinates partnership and operations for A Quick Brown Fox, which is founded by a black professional racing cyclist, Aisha McGowan, which is an organization that worked towards building spaces for bikes to thrive in cycling and the outdoors. Devin, welcome to KBOO Radio Show.
Hi, thank you, Nedra, for that intro, and thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, on behalf of Alon and Tie-Dye, we welcome, and we have some very warm weather here in Atlanta, so hopefully this would be a cool and relaxing conversation. Here on this show, we like to start, ease into a conversation with a little bit of backstory for each guest to find out how you got into the bicycle and made it a part of your life.
What's your story? I actually rode quite a bit as a kid. I have an older brother who's about 15 months older than me, and so we rode as children, but then in 2011, I was living in D.C. doing AmeriCorps, and my brother was a bike messenger in Chicago, and he was building single-speed bikes, and I was trying to get around D.C. affordably, and my brother said, I'll put a bike together for you. So in 2011, I got that bike, flew to Chicago, grabbed that bike for my brother, and then started my journey as a bike commuter in D.C. Fast forward, and I was car-free for 10 years, five in D.C., and then another five here in Atlanta. But now I have since acquired a car, but has still made cycling a part of my life. So it really started as a way to get around when I was a full-time volunteer and a way to save money.
Yeah, I mean, it is that community work that brings it to the forefront now. Who knew that the way you started was going to get a bike, flying to get a bike would be kind of normal for you, flying around the world for cycling? So at this point, you are a huge bike advocate, yes, with a lot of organizations and in your own personal writing that you do. You do a lot of speaking and sharing and advocating.
So how would you describe your leadership, and how have you leveraged your experiences and development and an event to really build what you're doing now?
Yeah, so I'll start from the beginning a little bit. I actually, like I said, I was car-free in Atlanta for a while and was spending a lot of time in the bike advocacy world as a volunteer initially, just interested in kind of riding around Atlanta and riding safely. And so that's sort of the beginning of the advocacy here in 2015. Kind of started 2015, but really got into it in 2018, working with the local advocacy group in Atlanta. And then shortly, gosh, I want to say just a year before the pandemic, I was really looking to, I was craving community in the cycling world. I had gone on a bike packing trip with some friends that really sort of moved me. It was a really challenging, difficult trip. I went with a couple of women-identified folks, and after that sort of was like, you know, I want to do this again, but I recognize that, you know, I don't have the right bike or the right gear, and this is really expensive. And so just sort of did a bit of research around what was existing in the current kind of climate around bike packing, bike camping, and, you know, the organizing around spaces intended for women, trans, femme, and non-binary riders. And Nedra, that's how I found you, actually, through Civil Bikes. And that kind of started that journey as well. But I kind of made an assessment that, you know, there wasn't this happening in Atlanta, you know, that overlap of like folks biking, camping, and doing sort of the off-road riding and for spaces that were catered towards non-cis men. And so I was like, well, I want to create this thing. I'm looking for a community. I'd love to, you know, help folks get gear to do this. You know, I knew folks who had the gear. Let's start, you know, figuring out a way to make this happen. And that kind of launched what is now known as Radical Adventure Riders Atlanta. And it's really through the start of that I then was able to connect with folks in other cities that were organizing around creating spaces for other groups of people. And those touch points allowed me to start having some outreach with sponsors who were working with communities focused on women, trans, femme, and non-binary athletes, and also events were being kind of put on, gravel events were coming up at the same time. And so I had the opportunity to ride for a gravel race team, which then allowed me to be in spaces where I was connecting with other riders who were women, trans, women, non-binary, spaces that sponsors were at. And I was noticing these events were sort of, you know, just not always a safe space for folks who were not your typical cisgendered male. And so me, along with the gravel team I was on and other friends, decided to just start having these conversations, you know, what does it look like to make a welcoming, inclusive space at these gravel race events? And then, you know, I was doing the same thing with RAR Atlanta, kind of locally here. And fast forward, and I have been able to develop relationships with different sponsors, different race events, and I'm sort of, you know, not as much a racer as I was before, kind of shifting my focus, but really kind of acknowledging that there are folks who want to ride gravel, who want to be outdoors, want to be on bikes, who want to be in, you know, courageous spaces with folks that are like alike and different from them. And because I've been able to be in those scenes and connect with those people that have sort of the resources to reallocate, I've had the opportunity to provide, you know, gear. You know, we have a gear library at RAR, been able to provide access to events, free and reduced events, also just putting on community events where folks can meet one another, be in a space where they can learn, feel empowered, and do this thing that, you know, initially I was craving community and experiencing bike joy, and now being able to just kind of pass that along and decreasing some of those barriers to getting there feels like something that I sort of fell into, but am now, you know, intentionally doing. And it's really a joy space to be able to provide those things based on the relationships that I have and kind of the inroads I've been able to make, and kind of connecting that resource allocation feels really important, because these things are exciting and fun, but also the barriers to get to them are, you know, just sometimes insurmountable. So I'm happy that I'm in this space to kind of connect those dots and be the bridge pathway in many of the avenues that I've worked in. if that makes sense.
Yes, it makes perfect sense. Thanks for sharing a good portion of your story. And you've come, I would say, it's not necessarily a long way. I mean, I think you've just further realized your plan. What you had shared with me, yeah, exactly that time we met many years ago now at this point. The fact that you were centering belongingness, and it not only is expressed in words, but there's like a feeling attached to it. You just talked about challenges that you face personally and also a need of community and to connect, and then reducing barriers to doing these types of rides, be it gravel, bike packing, just being on a bike, going into new spaces and places. What are you building towards now? You just talked about your shift, you know, as an athlete into more building these community spaces. Can you share what your, do you have a vision for what you would like to do?
Yeah, so, you know, so early on when I kind of mentioned this, but this idea of, you know, the gear being half the battle, and I think that when I started out, I was just borrowing bags from friends and kind of making it work. And so that was sort of a grassroots version of kind of, you know, a gear share, right? And so I think fast forward to now, if we, Raw Atlanta has a gear library, which we've opened up, and that is something that we now actually have, you know, an online catalog, the gear in here that's all been donated, that's new, that's stored in a physical space we have. And I think my plan and vision for this future, along with my team, because I will acknowledge that, you know, none of this is done solo. I've been able to do a lot of this with the support of my team, which I'm very grateful for. And I think for the future, you know, what the goal is and the dream sort of plan is that, you know, we already have this gear library and we're renting out, and it started as a bike packing gear library. We're renting out bike bags to put on your bike, renting out camping gear, so your sleep setup, you know, tent, sleeping pad, sleeping bag, sleeping bag liner, and then also, you know, a jet boil or like food utensils. So, you know, started kind of there, and we're continuing to kind of extend that. And we had a target of getting 15 sort of bike camping kits that we could rent out, and that has expanded now, and we've got some bikes that we're going to be able to rent out, and we want to kind of grow that to hopefully in the future have something like an outdoor recreation kind of gear library, right? And that would hopefully be something where, you know, we're renting out bike gear, but we could also rent out maybe hiking sticks or day packs or binoculars for birding, right? So a range of different outdoor recreation activities that someone just comes in, you know, all you need to have is an interest, right? You want to try something out, you don't want to make that financial commitment, or you can't, doesn't matter, but you can try this thing that you've had interest in, and the barrier to get there is low, right? And so really kind of going towards that direction, I think one thing we've noted and we want to work on as well is developing routes for people. I think this idea of urban bike packing is really key, and so we want to say, you know, you can go from your front door on a weekend and experience nature and not have to pay for it, right? So I think a lot of bike camping comes up as a super epic thing. You have to go to these faraway places. You know, I feel really blessed that we're in Georgia and we've got access to this extreme biodiversity, right? We've got nature literally at our back door. So if someone who comes in who's working a 9-to-5, you know, during the week, wants to go bike camping on a weekend when they're not working, they can rent a bike, rent the gear, and get a route that we put together that is aimed at someone who's newer to bike camping. They can go, you know, 20 miles one way camp and then come back, and we've got the kit and gear that they need, right? And so our hope is that folks would try us out, you know, and attempt to do the trip and or take friends, whatever, and then, you know, invite, tell someone else about us or do it again, or then, you know, work to create their own kind of set of gear. But at the very least, they've had an experience that they hopefully enjoyed and they didn't have to pay anything to do it, right? So that's really kind of the aim, the direction that we're going. I mean, we want to do that, but really having a, you know, physical space that's like really outdoor recreation, like think about a library. And there's models like this, right, in other places. They just look a little different. So I know Seattle has like, you know, a gear shop, and it's like a community center where they can rent stuff out and they charge a fee or something or membership. We're not there yet, because I do want to continue to acknowledge that, you know, we make no money from this, my team, and sometimes just having Seth be free can help people come along, right, just to try it. So we're not there where we're charging a membership fee. We just want folks to, you know, be within our community to try it out, and we try and have a conversation with them and learn about their trip and see what they want to do. But we're not requiring anything from you aside from, you know, signing some forms around, you know, liability and that sort of thing. So, yeah, that's kind of the vision and our ethos and goals for the future.
Yeah, that's not and a lot of work, and I'm glad you have some support, and hoping that you will get those resources that you need to continue building towards your goal. If I was listening right now, I am listening, but someone in the audience is listening to you and is very interested, however, they might be kind of like, huh, I don't know who's there. Can you describe your membership? Like, who's a part of RAW?
Yeah, so RAW is intended for folks who identify as women, folks who identify as trans, folks who identify as non-binary, folks who identify as femme. And so that means that we are kind of acknowledging that the cycling industry and outdoor community has historically catered towards cisgender men. And so our community is focused on not that demographic, and not saying that resources shouldn't be available for that demographic, but we have acknowledged that as underrepresented, underserved, or rather communities historically have not been given, you know, the same sort of opportunities, right, by the systems that be. And so we are focused on encouraging those folks. Our community tends to bend queer. That is a very big piece for me as a queer person. And we also are really wanting to center Black folks, Indigenous folks, people of color within this. And so those are our priorities, just in terms of saying, you know, this is a courageous space. And I use the term courageous because I think that safe space often can take some assumptions around who's in that space, you know. And so we want to provide courageous space for folks who are showing up among those identities. And so that's what our group looks like. And that, you know, I'm a Black queer woman, and our space reflects, you know, a range of the different identities I just said. And that's where we are right now. And that feels important to me and close to my heart. And that's sort of how our demographic is represented. I hope that made sense.
Sounds like it's is what it's called, authentic inclusion. People are represented, well represented, and can show up and be themselves and are empowered to participate. So that's great. Just to transition a little bit to another topic, although you just announced, I guess, that you're kind of leaving your athleticism, your competitive competition, I guess, on the side maybe. What has it been like being an adult athlete, an adult cyclist?
Yeah, so I will say, I guess I'll clarify. So I was doing a lot of gravel races. That was kind of my focus. Now I'm really more focused on, and gravel races are typically can range in different distances, but I have decided to shift my focus to doing some stuff more regional specific to the Southeast, and also some longer events like bike packing races. So I'll say for me personally, I'm kind of shifting to more of a what I'll call a deeper mental physical challenge for myself. But I will say that, you know, being an adult athlete, and I'll say sometimes I refer to myself as a non-competitive athlete, and I say that because the challenge is for me personally, right? I'm not competing against other people, not trying to win anything, but I am focused on, you know, seeing what my body can do and where my body can go. I think that it's definitely something I did not envision being in this place, you know, 5-10 years ago even. And it's something that surprisingly brings me a lot of joy. I think I grew up playing sports. I feel that sports are important in youth and can teach you a lot of skills and that sort of things, and life lessons can be gleaned from those. And I think that as a adult athlete, I am sort of kind of tapping into some of that childhood kind of joy of being like physical and outside and that kind of thing, but also kind of surprising myself pretty regularly. You know, I'm almost 37, which doesn't, you know, I don't feel old necessarily, but my body does feel different. And it has been kind of a challenging balance too, right? Making time for working out semi-regularly. You know, I do have a job, and so just carving out time on the weekends. But I think I have been able to experience sort of a range of joy around, you know, being on the bike for long periods of time, tapping into different mental spaces that I haven't gone to, right, in my adult life. And also just, you know, learning more about myself emotionally, spiritually, physically, and those have been opportunities for growth and learning and have brought a lot of satisfaction to my soul and my spirit. And so it's something that's fun and sometimes challenging, but I think, you know, to have the opportunity to move my body in these ways for this period of time, for a long period of time at this point in my life, feels like a gift. So that's kind of those are my feelings on that adult athlete side.
Great. And with that backpacking, what has been probably the most either challenging or just greatest experiences that you've had traveling by bike? Event.
Yeah, so I'll say two things. The first is that I had an opportunity last year to go to Spain for 2.5 weeks, and I spent 8 days on my bike in a really remote area of Spain, and it was one of the hardest things, probably still top, one of the hardest things I've ever done. But I had the opportunity to be outside on my bike for that period of time, interacting with very few people and just taking in landscapes I've never seen. I had the opportunity to practice Spanish, which is a language that I continue to learn and with a goal of having some fluency in the future. And even at my low point, I was like, I am in a remote town in Spain, eating bocadillo, experiencing nature, different forms of nature, connecting with the land in these new ways. And so that was really, really just breathtaking and hard, because it was the mountains. And then I most recently actually did a bike, ultra endurance bikepacking race in Texas. And this was a lot more of a physical challenge than the Spain challenge was. The Spain event was physical, but this was just a different sort of physical challenge. But I spent 3 days in East Texas. I did a 280-mile bikepacking trip, and it's the longest amount of time I've spent on my bike consecutively with the most amount of weight. And I set a goal to finish in 5 days, and that included sleeping. And I finished in 3 and experienced the type of euphoria I have never gone to. And so that was sort of the seed has been planted now for me to continue to do some ultra endurance events. And I truly felt like I, you know, on that ride kind of hit rock bottom and came back up. And so I've had the experience of just going to these new, you know, rooms in my mind. And also I'm very proud of myself for pushing through physically and mentally and finishing that in a shorter time than I intended. And now I'm like, wow, I did that and I could do it again. And that feels really empowering and exciting to kind of see that I'm, you know, moving into my late 30s and still can do, you know, a physically challenging thing and feel good about it and recover adequately and be injury free. So that that was really fun.
That sounds amazing. And glad that you're still continuing to stay physically engaged. And I guess we're nearing towards our last question before I turn it back over to Alon. If you were going to give someone, not a piece of advice, but someone who, say, in their community, they wanted to solve a challenge and create a space for inclusion, a space that is welcoming and inviting people to a community around cycling, what would you share with them?
Yeah, so a few things. I would first say, you know, start where you are with what you have. Scan the landscape. Ask the right questions. If you're looking to create community, does something already exist that you can sort of add on to? Are you filling a void in a space? What's happening around you? How long have you been in that community? Who can you get to know to kind of learn what's going on? You know, it's very human and American to jump into something and say, I'm going to create this and do this, right? Without sort of kind of seeing what already exists. And so doing that due diligence around research, I think, is really key. And humbling oneself, you know, I think sometimes we think we know everything. And I think it's very important to understand that we can all learn. We can all give something and receive something. So entering in a space where you're going to be inclusive, create community, and I think things can be different for someone who may be a person of color versus someone who is a white person, just in terms of the community you're trying to create and who you're going to invite in. And so asking those questions in that research, staying humble, and understanding that, you know, your capacity too, right? You don't have to do everything in one day. You know, I'm always reminding myself that I don't have to scale up if we're not ready to scale up, right? So what does it look like to start small and stay small and grow organically, right? So I think those would be my top things. Start where you are with what you have, ask the right questions, scan the landscape, and stay humble. Those are sort of my few sentences. I think everyone, we're all kind of going through something, experiencing something, and as much as we can understand one another, ask questions, be humble, it really helps to connect and make people feel welcome. I think that's really important.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Devin. I enjoyed and how would you tell KBOO audience how they can find you?
Yeah, so I'm on Instagram as DEV, so my first name, DEV underscore, part of my first name, underscore ROX, and we are also on Instagram as RAR Atlanta, so that's RAR dot Atlanta. So we'd be happy to connect with folks, and, you know, I'd like to consider myself as someone who's very approachable, so I welcome folks to ask questions, engage with me with whatever comes up. But thank you for the opportunity to be in conversation, and looking forward to just staying in touch on these issues.
Thank you so much, Devin. I am Nedra Deadweiler with Alon Robb, and we have just interviewed Devin Cowens of RAR ATL. Turn it back over to you, Alon. Thank you, Devin.
Yeah, thank you, Nedra, and thank you, Devin, for a wonderful interview, very inspiring, and all the best to you. Before we end, we're almost at the end of our show, but I would like to suggest also looking at Bike Portland, the wonderful online magazine devoted to cycling in Portland and beyond. And there's been a lively and important debate about the state of cycling in our city in Portland, since sadly there's been some stagnation in the number of riders and some safety issues, despite the tremendous progress made in infrastructure and education. So, and hopefully in the future we'll have some debate about that, some discussion about that important topic. You have been listening to the KBOO Bike Show. My name is Alon Robb, and I would like to thank our guests, Jessica Cherry and Devin Counts, co-host Nedra Deadweiler, our engineer Ty Walker and Chris Smith and Josh Hedrick for making all shows available at bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. And a big thank you to you, our listeners, who make this show possible. I hope that the coming month is a good month for all of you and for the world. I also hope that the days ahead will see more actions towards making our home, the Earth, more bike-friendly, environmentally conscious, and centered not on greed and hate, but on human and planetary needs and sustainability. Thank you for joining us today, and may your rides be safe, enlightening, and joyful.
Takes two wheels and no gasoline to keep yourself
your bicycle. Let's get together and leave our cars home. Everybody, get on your bicycle. Let's get together to pedal and roam. You can take a ride up in Forest Park. You can ride with the light if you ride in the dark.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 11:59 a.m. Stay tuned at noon for the news.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Jazz Lives, right after these news headlines.